This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we head into the kitchen with award-winning cookbook author and celebrated pastry chef Regan Daly. Daly is the author of In the Sweet Kitchen, The Definitive Baker's Companion. The book received the 2001 Cookbook of the Year Award from the International Association of Cooking Professionals. The cookbook contains lots of recipes. There are simple recipes and sophisticated recipes. You'll find a recipe called Deep Chocolate Pudding, or This Ain't No Instant Pudding, and a recipe called All in the Pan Chewy Chocolate Cake with Chocolate Butter Icing. Then there's Gingerbread Soufflé with a White Chocolate Creme Anglaise, and Calvados Parfait with Caramelized Griddled Apples. In the Sweet Kitchen also explains the techniques needed to make perfect desserts. There's information about the chemistry involved in baking, and the book includes information on ingredients and how to store them. Listeners, I invite your questions about desserts and baking for Regan Daly. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Regan Daly, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. When did you begin making desserts?
Ages and ages ago. I mean, you know, little kid is probably the best place to start. I was really lucky. I have a mother who's a wonderful baker and two grandmothers who were great bakers. And so it was natural. It was just something I did, you know, like coloring and riding a tricycle.
Yeah. And you stuck with the desserts. You decided to make that your career. Did you ever also, were you interested in other kinds of cooking?
Very much. Actually, I hadn't intended to make pastry or desserts my career. I went to cooking school for cooking, not in baking. I hadn't had any professional experience at the time I went to cooking school, and I would say the bulk of the experience I had just on my own had been with baking, but it certainly wasn't a conscious effort to go into it. And I ended up working for that most of the time I was working in restaurants. I was both the pastry chef in whatever restaurant I was working at, but I also worked the line. I also did the savory cooking as well. So it wasn't until the last couple of years I was working that I was exclusively a pastry chef.
Mm. It wasn't in cooking school that you learned about the wonders of the vanilla bean.
It wasn't. It really wasn't. So people who despair about not being great cooks because they haven't gone to cooking school, don't. they're great, but they're limited. And certainly my experience with food, my kind of understanding of it, expanded just hugely when I left cooking school and started working in small restaurants with really very, very talented chefs who were concerned about not kind of architectural food and being on the cutting edge of things, but being making food with a lot of integrity, a lot of care, a lot of simplicity. And the first time that I ever smelled or encountered a vanilla bean, I was working in a very small kitchen with a couple of excellent, excellent chefs in charge. And one day I was making creme brulee, and someone walked in, and the chef walked in, and he had a vanilla bean for me. And I sort of thought, this big, black, ugly, shriveled-looking thing couldn't possibly be, the source of the wonderful vanilla flavor. And even before he split it open, I could smell it. But when he cut it open and the paste was exposed, these miniature, tiny, tiny, tiny black seeds in this sticky paste that run down the center of this bean. And the kitchen was completely permeated with this smell. It was just overwhelming. I can't emphasize it enough. And that one single experience, kind of in a nutshell, is the truth about baking, the fact that something so simple, you know, using this particular ingredient instead of what comes in the little bottle, you know, in the supermarket shelves, that the difference between those two nearly knocked me over. And if that's all you have to do to get that much of a better result, then baking's a lot less complicated than most people think it is.
Well, you say over and over in the Sweet Kitchen, use the best ingredients you can.
Yeah. It was why I wrote the book. It really was. I'd wished when I was working that there was a book around that described the ingredients that were available now. And if you live, you know, where I live in Toronto or in Chicago or virtually anywhere in North America right now, either by mail or on foot, you have access to ingredients of unbelievable quality from all over the world. And there was very little at the time that would help someone, either a complete amateur or, like I was, a professional, kind of navigate through that whole landscape. And that was where I sort of, that combined with this, you know, revelation about what an impact the ingredients make, that was completely why the book got written.
Yeah. On the cover, on the jacket of the book, a bundle of vanilla beans.
Mm-hmm.
Can you
so
use...
decadent. That's probably $70 or $80 worth right there.
Can you use a vanilla bean? How do you use a vanilla bean? Can you use it in place of vanilla extract?
You can in some recipes. The beauty of vanilla extract is it infuses immediately. And there are, I should say, some excellent vanilla extracts out there that make the stuff you buy in sort of the corner store absolutely pale. So you don't necessarily always have to use the actual bean. But there are several different ways to use it. You can use either the whole bean intact or split down the middle to infuse a form of liquid, like a poaching syrup or a custard or an ice cream base or a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
You can scrape out the seeds and use them in another context that's a little more solid. Most cases, it's best if you're using the seeds that they have some liquid to get into or they're heated at some point. So they're not the ideal in every cake or in cookies because they just don't get mixed enough and their flavor doesn't get to kind of infuse enough. But even in those cases, I have made both cakes and cookies using vanilla beans as long as you kind of agitate them and, you know, for lack of a better word, sort of smear them around and release those oils and that flavor.
Mm. Let's go back to your childhood. I'm interested in what your favorite desserts were as a child.
Oh, simple stuff. Chocolate layer cake and lemon pound cake. And I loved lemon meringue pie. This was before I discovered, you know, French lemon curd tart. I was a big lemon meringue pie fan. Chocolate chip cookies, really chewy ones. Great simple desserts. One of my grandmothers lives in Northern Ontario, and it's a region that's completely barren almost, with the exception of blueberries, little tiny wild lowbush blueberries. So every summer I'd go up to my grandmother's place and we'd make, you know, reams of pies and jams, and she'd give me some extra pastry and I'd make, you know, turnovers with it. And they're still my favorite desserts.
Hmm.
You know, as many different places as I've eaten and as elaborate as the desserts have gotten, you can get fancier, but you can't really get better than a really great, you know, blueberry pie that's still warm.
Yeah. I imagine that there are a lot of people listening this afternoon who are a little intimidated by pie, and that's because the crust can be a challenge.
Yeah, people over... I used to be such a person. I was terrified when I was younger to kind of negotiate making pies. And through sort of exploring it a little bit, people are a little bit too concerned. You know what I mean? They kind of cripple themselves before they even start by being overly anxious about it. A couple of things you have to remember when you're making pie crust are everything should be cold as possible without being frozen. And that includes the flour, the flour mixture in the bowl, the butter certainly, or shortening or lard, whatever you're using, certainly whatever liquid or egg that you're using, very, very, very cold. And if you're a person who has cold fingers, you'll make great pie crust. I know lots of women who are exactly like that. So, and if you're a person who has very warm fingers, run them under some cold water before you make the crust, just so that you don't melt the butter, melt the fat into the pastry. And the second thing is, quickly, everything quickly. You should be able to make, especially if you've got a food processor, which is wonderful for starting the crust, you should be able to make the dough in, I'd say, a minute to 2 minutes. It's very, very, very fast. And like I said, if you do have a food processor, and I love using a food processor to start pastry, and by start I mean put the flour and the salt in the mixer, in the food processor, pulse it once or twice just to mix it, add the shortening or the butter, which you've cut up into very small pieces. The smaller the better, because you'll have less work to do and therefore less agitation to put your flour through, which means your pastry won't be tough. Put the butter in, pulse it a couple of times just until, and feel it every couple of seconds, or after every pulse or two. And when you've got the largest lumps about the size of big peas, dump it out into a bowl, add the liquid, and use just sort of the first two knuckles of your finger, of your fingers, and toss the dough as though you're, playing in the sand or tossing a salad. Just sort of run your fingers through the dough until it sort of clumps together. That's it. People get, I think, a little anxious, and they start to overwork it, and they become very laborious about it, and they check it too many times, and you could almost do it blindfolded, and the lightness with which you would do it would probably produce a good crust.
Lightly, quickly, and with cool fingers.
And very, very cold. And if you're worried about the cold thing, if it starts to get a little warm or you're concerned about it, pop the whole bowl back in the fridge for 5 minutes.
Mm. There's a photograph of a raspberry pie in the book, In the Sweet Kitchen, and it looks so wonderful. And here's my question. This is kind of can be a wet fruit, raspberries. How do you work with fruit that can be a little wet?
Well, one of the things about pie baking, the best pie bakers are the most experienced ones, and there's a reason. That's because fruit is always different. So I'll get blueberries one week or raspberries one week, and then I'll get them, a month later. And they may be not as sweet or sweeter, not as juicy or juicier. And the filling in pies are very, very flexible. So while there is a recipe, and certainly there's a recipe in my book, and there's recipes all over the place, there's a huge kind of space for flexibility and variation. If you think that you've got particularly sweet raspberries, or you're someone who doesn't like a very sweet filling, use less sugar. That's totally fine. If you think that your berries are a little extra juicy and you're a little concerned, you're probably right. Your instincts are probably good. Mm. And add a little bit more of the starch, whatever the starch is in the filling. The more you do it, the more you'll know for a fact. But I also think that most people's instincts are really good when it comes to baking and things like that. It's the same thing if, your recipe says for a cake, bake 30 minutes or until such and such. If you look at it after 22 minutes and you think it pretty much looks done, don't shut the oven and leave it in there for another 8 minutes unless the recipe specifically says, even if it looks done at 20 minutes, don't take it out. I think a lot of people, especially with baking, feel so uncertain that they kind of relinquish all responsibility in terms of their own instincts. And, they set the timer and they leave the room and they go watch a movie and they come back when the timer goes off. In fact, you probably know. You're probably right. If you think it looks done, it's probably done. Mm. And if you think it needs another 10 minutes, even if it's been already 5 minutes longer than the recipe said, you're probably right in that case, too. There's a lot of reasons why that could be so. It could be the recipe, could be your oven, could be the day.
Mm-hmm. So use your nose, too, I suppose.
Totally. Your nose and your mouth. I mean, speaking about ingredients, if you're preparing something, a savory dish, a casserole or a roast or whatever, a lot of the ingredients that go into it along the way, you'd nibble, you'd taste. You take a bit of the carrot or you try a bit of the stuffing or whatever. Because a lot of things in dessert cooking have to be cooked and they aren't really in their edible state until they're done, a lot of people, I think, don't use the same senses in the same way as they do with cooking. If you're making a sauce, you'll taste it all the way along. If you're making a pasta sauce or a soup, you'll taste it three or four times before it's done, but you can't really do that with a cake. What you can do is smell the butter, make sure it's sweet, smell the flour, make sure it's fresh, try the pecans, taste the chocolate. You can still satisfy all of those kind of impulses, and you can get all of that information just in a different way.
Was there a particular dessert or a particular technique, element of a dessert that you found it tough to master?
I was just terrible at making cookies. I was, my entire teenagehood, I had been branded absolutely the worst cookie maker ever. I either made little rocks or I made puddles that kind of, you know, oozed over the entire cookie sheet. And I'm really not exaggerating. I was really atrocious. And I finally, what finally solved that problem and made me not so terrified of making them anymore was learning a little bit about what happens in the recipe, learning what the butter does and what the sugar does, and that if you have, you know, less butter in a recipe, it will tend to be more solid, a little bit more, less tender, sort of. It will also melt and bleed less all over your cookie sheet. More butter will tend to do that more. And I think I'm not naturally a very, well, in some things, I was going to say I'm not naturally a very meticulous person. In some cases, I am. I'm also, I think, a very intuitive cook. So I like the, you know, the pinch and dash kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work all the time. And it works if you know what you're doing. But I really didn't know what I was doing, and I was still trying to get away with it. So what helped me was understanding what the recipe means, what it does, what you know, just a little bit about what each ingredient, how they function in each recipe, or in, not even in each recipe, in each type of dessert. And once I knew that, then I was instantly, without even having to think about it, more careful to execute the recipe properly. I would use the same kind of butter every time. I would measure my ingredients properly, which I wasn't doing. I would make sure that the quantities were consistent. And then the problems, you know, what problems don't disappear, you can figure out.
Hmm. I'm interested in your use of intuition, your intuitive thinking in the kitchen. There is a recipe in the book for sweet potato cornbread.
Mm-hmm.
And what a great idea, but it would never occur to me. Do you know what I mean?
Really? Well,
you know, what was the inspiration for pairing, you know, cornmeal and mashed sweet potato?
Oh, well, that they sound so good together. I mean, that's sort of how I think I come up with most of my recipes is from flavors that I like together, and then figuring out sort of where that begins and where that stops and what other things could go well. And only then figuring out, well, is this going to be a pudding or is this going to be a cake? Yeah, I mean, a lot of things are, just seem very natural, just like colors that would go together well. Sweet potato is very autumnal and kind of, you know, sweet and dark, and cornmeal just sounds like something that would go beautifully with that. Something with a little bit of a nuttiness and a butteriness and sweetness. And I think I end up with a lot of recipes by approaching it that way, by thinking, gee, you know, those would go really well together. What can I do with that? Is it going to be an ice cream or is it a cake? Or, that's how I've always sort of approached cooking. Sort of technique second for me. Not that it's secondary importance, but more from the point of view of the way, you know, again, it's going back to savory food, walking around a market and seeing fresh tomatoes at one stall and fresh basil at another and just thinking, gosh, that's a great combination. Let's try that.
Mm. You know, going back to the idea of the raspberry pie and how raspberries from 1 week to another can differ over the season,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when I go to the store these days, I don't go with, I'm going to get asparagus. If the asparagus looks good,
right,
I'll get it. And also I'm thinking now that with fruits and with, as you said, you know, should this be a pie? Should it be a bread? Should it be an ice cream?
Right.
You really need to maybe take the same attitude toward things you're going to use for desserts in the kitchen. In other words, if those raspberries are really sweet, maybe they should be made not into a, and they're, you know, really juicy.
Yeah.
Maybe they shouldn't be a pie. Maybe they're crying out to be something else.
Yeah, maybe just in a bowl with some whipped cream.
Yeah, or over some ice cream.
Exactly. And that's I think that's something we're not very far away from, but for some reason it's a bit of a hurdle to think about sweet things that way. People, I think, have become a lot more confident about looking at food in that way. You know, you don't necessarily plan down to the last, vegetable exactly what you're going to have a week from now or 2 weeks from now. And by the flip side of that is you can be inspired by the condition and the sort of the availability of what you're looking at in the market. One of the things I included in the book, and I'm actually very glad it's there because I didn't know if anybody would care about this except me, is a section called a flavor pairing chart, which you just reminded me of because of what you're saying about sort of going in and seeing the fruit either in one condition or another, or having the idea to make raspberry pie and then the raspberries don't look so great, but the blackberries look fantastic, or the blueberries look perfect and they're a great price. And this chart is set up in kind of an easy access at a glance way, with ingredients on one side and flavors that pair well with them beside them. So beside almonds, there might be apricot and orange and chocolate and honey and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in a little box. And there might be anywhere from 10 to 30 different flavors. But the idea was to give people a little bit of inspiration if they want it, but also a little bit of ammunition to expand recipes they already have that they love, that they want to do a variation on, or to find a way to create new things by being inspired by the products themselves. So like I said, if you go in and you see these fabulous raspberries, but you're a little reluctant to put them in the pie, or you don't have 6 cups of them, which you need for a pie, which is just about shameful, as I think I say in the book, 6 cups of raspberries.
Well, if you've got a patch in the yard, that's one thing.
That's
exactly. If you've got to pay a pretty penny for them at the grocery.
It's true, yeah. It's a once a year kind of pie, I think. But if you've got the 1 cup or the pint, and maybe you've got a recipe that you think they might work well in, but at this point it's made for apricots and peaches or something, you can use the flavor pairing chart just to give you a jumping off point. There's some references about like I said, modifying desserts you love or creating new ones.
This is coming off the top of my head now, but I'm interested in how you paired these things together. We're talking about raspberries. Raspberries, polenta, mascarpone, is that right? Honey and citrus zest.
And pistachios, I think.
And pistachios.
That's the little...
How did all that come together?
Well, I had been at an event at one point, where we were served little crostini, little canapes, on polenta, fried polenta squares, very sort of thinly sliced and fried. They were savory. They were, tomato and some other things. And I thought it's such a lovely idea. And I as you've already mentioned, 2 recipes that have cornmeal. I kind of like cornmeal. It seems to appear in a lot of my desserts. And so I thought of doing one that was kind of sweet. And so like this, what went through my mind is sort of a balance of flavors but also of textures. So in this case, you have the polenta square, which is sugared lightly and fried. So it's a little bit crispy, and then it's almost sort of cakey in the inside. And the mascarpone on top of that, which is just a lovely, totally unsweetened, just right out of the package. This unbelievably decadent, creamy little mouthful. And the rest of it was, just kind of a marriage of flavors. The raspberries, because they don't have an overpowering flavor, and part of their beauty is in that juiciness. So then you get this kind of fresh, this kind of brightness, which goes well with the polenta, which is not a bright flavor and is now fried, and the cream, which is, again, kind of heavy. So you want something with some acidity and some brightness to it. And then you've still all got fairly creamy, kind of soft textures. So the pistachios were partly for color, because that's just so gorgeous with the red and the yellow and the white, and partly for a little bit of crunch. And the honey, just to make sure you know it's a dessert, because so far it's not that sweet. That was it.
Marvelous. Also, I want to ask you about another thing, how it came together for you. And I also would like this afternoon, before our time is up, to share a recipe or two with our listeners. And
sure.
I also want to invite listeners to join us with a telephone call this afternoon. Let me reintroduce you, Regan. Regan Daly is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about desserts. She is the author of In the Sweet Kitchen, The Definitive Baker's Companion. The book received the 2001 Cookbook of the Year Award from the International Association of Cooking Professionals. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls this afternoon. Questions, comments, they're welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've got a listener. A couple listeners now waiting to talk with us, so let's go and talk with these callers. First, we're going to go to someone on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. I just have a comment. I thought your guest might find it interesting, but I'm from Ghana in West Africa, and there's a pretty popular dish that's made with corn maize meal sweetened with sweet potatoes.
Oh.
So I thought you might find that interesting to know.
Well, thank you very much for that. And is it a bread or is it a pudding or what is it?
It's kind of like a dumpling. It's served either steamed or baked, but it's cornmeal mixed with sweet potato to sweeten it. And it's usually served with a sauce, but you can eat it by itself.
I think I've heard of such things, and often they're steamed.
Right.
And I mean, thinking one thing I hadn't said before is, they're both indigenous, you know, American, North American ingredients. And that's a pretty good way to find out what marries well together is what's from the same region. You know, it's always said with wine, drink the wine of the region from where the food is. And I think that goes quite well in food as well, you know, in pairing flavors. So I think it probably is quite a much more common pairing in South America and Latin America.
Uh-huh. Well, I just thought I'd mention that you might find it interesting.
Thank you.
But your book sounds really intriguing. I'll go and look for it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
This afternoon. Next, we go to someone else in Champaign, this caller on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you for your enthusiasm. I had a question about pastry. One of my neighbors, who was a baker for a very long time, refuses to bake croissant dough here in Champaign-Urbana unless he uses distilled water, because we have very hard water here. It's very good water, but it's very hard. And I was curious, you had talked some about the chemistry of cooking. Are you aware of anything like that that would affect pastry dough, or what's your secret to...
I'm not surprised. In fact, that kind of thing, I think, affects sort of delicate preparations like breads and pastry doughs, not sort of delicate but sensitive, quite a lot, the same way humidity and temperature and everything else does. I haven't had much experience sort of working with different, you know, different water, different hardnesses or softnesses of water, but I'm not at all surprised that your friend or neighbor is kind of militant that way. With every kind of variable like that, sort of an environmental variable, be it altitude or humidity, that kind of thing, often if you find a recipe that works in your kind of locale for a product that is like that, that is possibly sensitive, a dough usually of some kind, then definitely use it. If you're finding that you're having the same problem over and over again with several recipes, and you know for a fact that there's kind of an oddity about your kind of your area, then you may start playing around a little bit. I wouldn't want to guess what to do to ameliorate kind of using hard water in a situation like that, because I'm not sure what effect it would have on the dough. The water here where I live is actually very, very good and quite neutral in terms of hardness or softness. But as with using any kind of product, butter or flour, if you find one that works, be faithful to it because there can be a lot of variation between things like that. And then again, I mean, using bottled water or distilled water in recipes is not a bad idea. It's usually a small amount. You know, it's not like it's going to be a big expense. And you'll be guaranteed to get a consistent result and one you can predict before you've done it.
And then if you could, I remember a taste from my childhood in California with Japanese bean paste. Do you know anything about how that's made? And I'll hang
up. Japanese
Thank
bean
you.
Paste?
Mm-hmm.
I love it. And there's a store in New York, actually, that I go to every time I'm there that makes incredible confections. But I'm afraid I don't know. I would be guessing, but I don't know. It's very similar, or it's slightly similar to sweetened chestnut puree. Hmm. Have you ever encountered that? It's sold in tins. It's usually made in France. And it's a very sticky, thick paste made from chestnuts. And because beans and chestnuts are that same, they've got a very similar kind of texture to them. They're a little drier and starchier than other nuts or whatever. I would think it might be a little bit similar, but I'm not familiar enough with Asian sweets to know much about it, I'm afraid.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. This caller mentions bean paste, and then we had the woman who called who'd come from Ghana. And I'm wondering, you know, as you travel, do you draw inspiration from the foods of other parts of the world?
Oh, very much. Very much. And I'm very, very lucky. Toronto is really one of the most multicultural cities in the world. And most of the city is broken up into fabulous little neighborhoods where you can walk into a corner store and get products that you couldn't possibly order anywhere else in the country, that are imported directly. And so there's, I've had some, many afternoons sort of spent coming home and looking at a bag of something that I've opened or brought home that I'm not really sure how to use or where to use. But I think on a smaller scale, everybody can do that even without traveling. Walk down, a slightly different aisle in your grocery store and think a little bit laterally about using the products. Different nuts than you would usually use in baking. Coconut products, coconut milk or the powdered coconut that is often used in Asian foods. Like I just spoke to the gentleman on the last caller, chestnut puree and chestnuts themselves. These types of products can either be integrated into recipes that are familiar or used as inspiration to create all sorts of new things.
Hmm. What was the inspiration for the olive oil and sweet wine cake?
That's actually not an uncommon type of cake in regions that produce both of those things. In oil, a lot of oil-producing regions, that is the fat. That is the fat that's available. They don't have butter, so most of the cakes use oil. And there are olive oil cakes, and there are sweet wine cakes. I know there are some others that use both, and I thought it would be a nice way to integrate them, where you could kind of choose one of each that complements the other, a very fruity olive oil and a nice fruity wine. But it is quite common it's not a fancy cake.
Right.
It would be kind of an at home
mm-hmm.
Sunday night cake for people who work in those regions.
Yeah. Very Mediterranean.
Very.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Well, hi. I just want to tell about the black bean paste.
Uh-huh.
That the previous caller asked. It's in a can.
I don't know that that's the same product. The black bean paste isn't. Is it a sweet paste?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then if you want to make from the scratch, you just have to boil azuki beans.
Right.
And then put in a blender and then put in a bag and let the water drain. And that's what the paste. And then you can cook with a little bit of sugar and oil to give that consistency. Mm. And the white filling on the beans, the sweet beans, then it's made of lima beans. And the black paste is made from adzuki beans.
That's interesting. The pastry, the little confections that I've had too have been made also from some actually from sweet potato, and some from red. A lot of them from red beans, red bean paste.
Right, and that's the zuki bean.
Right.
Yeah, the black bean. It's called black, but you know the same. Okay, thank you.
Thanks
for the call this afternoon. Regan Daly is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What recipe would you like to share with us this afternoon? And I think it should be something fairly simple so that people who are listening can get it all down.
Oh, boy.
There's the all-in-the-pan chewy chocolate cake comes to mind. And also there's a recipe for, I think it's pecans, maple pecans.
Little cookies?
No, it's just to use.
Oh, maple. Oh, right, right.
You toast them, I think. That's a nice little recipe for maple sugared pecans from using in different things.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Can you get maple sugar there readily?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know there have been places I've gone this year that have.
You have to look for it.
Yeah.
But I know that there's a store in Urbana that you can.
Well, either one of those is wonderful. The all in the pan chocolate cake.
Maybe that would be the one to go with.
This is the easiest cake in the history of the world. I can't take credit for it. I'm sure there are people out there who have almost identical recipes. And it became, I think, very popular when eggs and butter and dairy products, milk, were precious, you know, in the 30s and 40s and early 50s. And this is still the cake that I make for my sons at least once a month, and that is the birthday cake in our house, and my mother still makes for me, and so I stand by it like no other in the book. I'd be happy to.
That would be great.
Shall I just run down the ingredients?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For the cake, and you do not need a bowl even for this. If you are making just one recipe of it, it works beautifully doubled. But if you're just making one recipe, then in a 9x9 or 8x8 square pan, ungreased, unfloured, this is the easiest thing in the whole world, 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour, 1 cup of granulated sugar, 1/4 cup of natural unsweetened cocoa, which would be like Hershey's, not a Dutched version, 1 teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 6 tablespoons flavorless vegetable oil, such as canola, 1 tablespoon white vinegar, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, and 1 cup of cool water. And the method for this is combine the flour, the sugar, the cocoa, the baking soda, and the salt in the pan. Dump them in. Take a kitchen fork, just a regular fork. Stir them around until they look pretty much uniform to you. And then the fun part, don't ask me why you do this. You probably don't have to, but it's a great deal of fun. Certainly my sons would kill me if I stopped doing it. Make 3 wells, 1 fairly large and then 2 smaller ones. In the batter, in the dry ingredients. And into the largest well, pour the vegetable oil. Into the next one, pour the white vinegar. And into the last one, pour the vanilla extract. And then without mixing, pour the 1 cup of cool water all over the whole thing. Make a big mess. Stir it around with the fork until you're pretty sure you've gotten all of it. And pop it into a 350-degree oven. Honestly, you can have this cake in the oven within about 10 minutes from saying, gee, you know, cake would be good tonight. And it bakes for about 30 minutes, give or take. A wooden skewer inserted into the center should come out clean, and it should feel sort of springy on top. And cool it in the pan on a wire rack. You don't remove it from the pan or anything until it's completely cool. And then for the icing, this is just your kind of mix as the cake is cooling grandma icing. just a quarter cup of unsalted butter at room temperature, 2 cups of confectioner's sugar, 2 to 3 tablespoons milk or water, 1.5 tablespoons natural cocoa, unsweetened cocoa, and a teaspoon of vanilla extract. And basically cream the butter and 1 cup of the confectioner's sugar together until the butter's pretty evenly distributed. Stir in 1 tablespoon of milk or water, then sift in the cocoa powder and stir it around until it's blended. Then mix in the vanilla and the 2nd cup of confectioner's sugar. And then just as you're stirring, you can be using a wooden spoon or a fork, whichever makes you feel more confident about getting the lumps out. Add as much of the remaining liquid as you need to make the icing the right consistency. And you can ice this right in the pan and eat it right out of the pan. And in the book, there's a little note saying that I have been known, along with my sister, to polish off the better part of one of these cakes in one sitting. It's not a lie. It's totally true. Have done it more than once. Because you just sit there. You eat, you know, you serve one piece to everybody, and it's a nice, modest little piece. And then we just sit there with a glass of wine and forks and the pan, and it's gone.
And you can, depending on how many people you've got around, you can make this 2 pieces or 6 pieces or 9 pieces.
That's right, exactly. And it also doubles beautifully. And if you double it, you can bake it in a 9x13 pan, mix it in a bowl, bake it in a 9x13 pan, increase the baking time a little bit. You can also double it and make 2 round 8 or 9 inch layers and make a layer cake. Mm. And it's lovely. Mm. And it's just... It is just staggering how good it is for how much effort goes into it.
Yeah.
It is a totally satisfying, really moist, really chewy chocolate cake.
And you don't have to have anything fancy at all.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And this, honestly, this is as easy as a mix. It's probably ingredients that everyone has in their pantry at any time. You know, oil, a little bit of cocoa powder, flour, sugar, baking soda, salt, that's about it. And you... The difference between, you know, in taste between this and either a store-bought cake or a mixed cake is flooring, and it probably is no more effort whatsoever than the mix.
Mm. And also you suggest if you don't want to make the icing, just sprinkle a little powdered sugar or top a little ice cream.
Absolutely. And or if you've got a favorite icing recipe already, it'll take anything, this cake.
Tell us about just a little bit about writing and putting together this book. It is such a reference work. What was it like? You know, how did you decide what you wanted to put in there? And
well, I think that was the part that allowed me to be able to do it. I had about 2 years to write the book, but that was starting from a completely comprehensive outline. I knew when I sat down. Begin writing. I knew exactly what was going into the book. I had an outline and a plan and a proposal that included everything that's in there right now. So there wasn't ever a point during that 2 years when I had to say, "Okay, what comes next?" or "What else should I put in?" or "Where do I go now?" So it was an incredibly intensive period. But I think it was just because it was so personal. Because everything that's in the book is information or ideas that I would have appreciated, that I would appreciate having in a book, it was quite easy to determine what was to go in and what wasn't. So that, and that made it possible to do. If I'd really had to struggle with compiling this from the ground up, it would have been overwhelming.
Yeah. We've got a number of callers who are waiting to talk with us. I think we can squeeze in one more, but it'll have to be quick. Let's go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi, just real quick, could you go over the ingredients for that cake again?
Oh, okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call. Well,
okay.
Do you have that page there? Yeah, sure, go ahead.
All right, then. 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour, 1 cup sugar, that's granulated sugar, 1/4 cup of natural unsweetened cocoa, like Hershey's, 1 teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 6 tablespoons vegetable oil, 1 tablespoon vinegar, white vinegar, 1 teaspoon pure vanilla extract, 1 cup of cool water.
There you have it. I suspect that some of us will be eating cake this evening.
Well, now I'm inspired, too. I may just have to get up and do that.
Regan, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Regan Daly has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of In the Sweet Kitchen, The Definitive Baker's Companion. The book received the 2001 Cookbook of the Year Award from the International Association of Cooking Professionals. The book is published by Artisan, which is a division of Workman Publishing House. So, In the Sweet Kitchen, Regan Daly. Our thanks to Regan this afternoon.